Today, for our first hour, we're going to be considering the laws and covenants. This, of course, was developed during the period of the wilderness wanderings, and we have quite a bit of parallel material from the ancient Near East that will shed some light and I think put the biblical material in perspective. Both of these subjects are very large subjects, and we can only just touch on a few aspects, and perhaps you've already had some of this material in your other courses. I don't know what all is taught yet, so maybe this is old ground for you. But at any rate, we'll just kind of review some of this material from an archaeological point of view. The laws of Moses, of course, set the Israelites apart from the other nations around her. It was once said that the religion of Israel evolved from a more primitive state to a more advanced or lofty type of a religion. But we now know from archaeological findings that the Mosaic Law is quite unique, and it, in fact, was very different from anything else of that time period. So it doesn't appear to have evolved. It appears to have just suddenly appeared. The nations around Israel, of course, were pagan nations, and their systems, their legal systems and covenants and so on reflect that fact. We find that in these other nations, religion was used by the kings, the leaders, pretty much to control the people, the kingship and the religion, the organized religion kind of went hand in hand. There was no separation of church and state. And so religion was very much in the hands of the political authorities and very much used by them to control the people. Israelite religion, on the other hand, was totally different. And in Israelite religion, the relationship was between the people, the individuals, and God. And, of course, they had set up a temple and priesthood and all of that, but the covenant was between the people and God. The people were expected to obey the covenant, the laws, and if they did not, then they would answer directly to God. We see a number of aspects of the Mosaic Law that are quite different from the other law codes of other nations. We see that the law of Moses was moral, and this was totally lacking in the other law codes of the day. These other nations, these pagan nations, were caught up largely in fertility worship. That seemed to be the theme of most of these pagan religions. They were, of course, struggling for survival. And so they, I think, quite naturally began to worship the sun, the elements, the rain, and the earth, and so on, where they derived their livelihood. And everything was geared for reproduction. This was the whole thrust of their religion. Reproduction amongst themselves, to have a family, to carry on the family, to have children, to take care of you in your old age and so on. Reproduction in the flocks and herds, reproduction in the fields. And so they worshipped all of the various elements and the gods that they felt would ensure this reproduction. So when you come to Israelite religion, it's just like night and day. It's totally different from the religion of the surrounding nations. And this is something that we know now because of archaeology. We can put the Bible in its context and appreciate the uniqueness of the Old Testament. Well, let's talk about a few of these law codes, as they're called, or systems of laws. We have quite a number that have been found going back to even the 3rd millennium B.C. The earliest would be the law code of Ur-Nammu, who was the founder of the what's called the third dynasty of Ur. And this would date to the late 22nd century B.C. This law code was found in Nippur and in Ur. We have what has been discovered are really student copies that are later than the time of Ur-Nammu. They date to about 1800 to 1700, but the original laws go back to the time of this Ur-Nammu, founder of the third dynasty of Ur. They're written in Sumerian, and we have about 23 laws preserved. Then we have from the 20th century B.C. the laws of Ish-Nuna. These were excavated at Tel Abu Harmal, H-A-R-M-A-L, not too far from Baghdad. They were excavated by the Directorate General of Antiquities. These are written in Akkadian, and in this case we have 59 laws preserved. And these are in your Ancient Near East 133 to 138. Then we have the laws of Lipit Ishtar, who was a king of the city-state of Isin. And these date to the 19th century B.C. You can see all of these laws so far predate Moses by some centuries. Pardon? He was the king of Isin, I-S-I-N. And these were excavated at the city of Nippur by the University of Pennsylvania. Some of these are, I think, even on display at the University Museum. These are written, again, in Sumerian, and we have 37 laws preserved in this case. And then we have another group of Sumerian laws. Which date to about 1800 B.C. And in this case, we have about 10 laws preserved. I don't know if you have the Ancient Near East texts here, the large volume in the library. You probably do. Yeah, I ought to give you the reference in that. Yeah. They pretty much deal with one city-state. Yeah, the king of the city-state would draw up these laws, but a lot of them are duplications. You know, one would copy from the other. So.
Does that deal with religion?
Yeah, they would be tied in with their particular temple and so on. Let me give you the references in the ancient Near Eastern texts related to the Old Testament, what we call Annette. Even though these aren't in your Ancient Near East volume that we're using in the course here, they are published in this Annette, 523-25. And the laws of Lipit Ishtar, Annette 159-160. It's in one big volume, yeah. And then the Sumerian laws are 525 to 526. Then we have the famous Code of Hammurabi. two M's, U R A B I. And this is 18th, 17th century. These were written in Babylon, but they were carried off to Susa by the Elamites as a trophy of war, and that's where they were found, at Susa, by French archaeologists in the winter of 1901-1902. These are in Akkadian, and we have 282 laws. So here we have a very extensive collection. I think it's complete. It's on a large stela, and I think it is all there. And this is in Ancient Near East 138 to 167. And then we have a lot of miscellaneous Babylonian laws from later periods. And these are published in Annette 197-198. These, incidentally, are all from southern Mesopotamia. And then we can go to northern Mesopotamia, Syria, and we have more. We have Ebla, but these, unfortunately, have not been published yet. But these would be our earliest. These go back to the 24th, 23rd centuries B.C. There may be some Sumerian laws that go back that early that have been found, just small collections or a few laws on tablets here and there. But as far as I know, no large collections. And the Ebla material should be very interesting once it's published, because I think it gives us a fairly good set of laws from a very early time. Then there's a group of laws from Assyrian colonies. This is Cappadocia. And these date to the 19th century B.C. I am not sure where they're published, but they're out there somewhere. They have been published. They're not in ancient Near East text. And then we have Middle Assyrian laws. And these would be 15th century B.C. Now we're getting down to the time of Moses. These were excavated at Ashur, A-S-H-U-R, by German archaeologists back in the early years of this century, between 1903 and 1914. We have over 100 laws. And these are in Annette 180 to 188. And then from Asia Minor, or Anatolia, we have the Hittite laws. These were found at Boghaz Köi, the capital of the Hittite Empire. And these are all late second millennium. And here we have some 200 laws preserved. And these are published in Annette 188-197. So that's a rundown on some of the more important law collections that have been recovered through archaeological findings. We find that there's two types of laws here. What's called the casuistic law, C-A-S-U-I-S-T-I-C. And that this is the type that begins, if a man does such and so, then the penalty will be this and that. And then the second type, the apodictic. And this is the thou shalt not. And of course we're familiar with that type of a law from the Ten Commandments. But we have both types in the Old Testament. So we find similar laws, really, in the Old Testament and in the ancient Near East. The laws that are similar, we see, are the types of laws that are necessary for civilization to exist. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, and so on, those sort of general types of laws. But in the Old Testament, we have some unique aspects to these laws. Casuto sees three categories of judicial laws in the Old Testament with regard to the ancient Near Eastern laws that we have recovered. First, he sees laws that confirm aspects of the ancient Near Eastern legal tradition. In other words, the Old Testament law is basically the same as the ancient Near Eastern law. And so he says that confirms the relevance or the necessity of this particular ancient Near Eastern legal tradition. Then we have laws in the Old Testament that introduce amendments in the legal tradition of the ancient Near East. They've been modified in some way to fit God's purposes and to fit the Israelite scheme of things. And then thirdly, we have laws that oppose or invalidate particular aspects of the ancient Near East law tradition. So the Old Testament law is not simply a copying of these older laws, but it's a revision in some cases, a total changing of the laws, and in some instances it is a duplication. So when we compare the two sets of laws, we see quite a number of differences. Of course, critics point to the similarities, and they say, well, the Bible writers just copied these over. But when you look at the differences, you see that they are quite significant. First of all, probably the most important difference is that biblical law sets a supreme value on human life, whereas the laws of the other nations put the supreme value on the sanctity of property. That was more important in their eyes than human life. So this immediately causes quite a significant difference between the two bodies of law. Biblical law is very severe on homicide and lenient on property offenses. And it's just the opposite in these other non-biblical laws. They are very severe on property offenses and very lenient on homicide. We see that the biblical laws were issued by Israel's God, not by a king. Of course, the other laws are issued by a king. We see in the Old Testament, God is responsible for carrying out many of these penalties. Many times in the biblical law, we see that the reason for the law is stated, and the purpose that it's given is stated. In the Old Testament law, we have moral and ethical directives, and these are totally unknown in the pagan religion. They were immoral religions, and there was no morality at all in them. We find in the biblical law there's no class distinctions. Male-female relationships are equally treated, whereas we have class distinctions in these other law systems. Yeah.
Dr. Lee, backing up that last point, what do you mean by moral and ethical?
Well, sexual, mainly. The other religions were very sexually oriented, you know, with temple prostitution and all that sort of thing. The gods were involved in all kinds of immoral acts, and morality, sexual morality, just wasn't part of their religion or their law system, whereas in the Bible we find a high moral ethic.
Okay, but there were laws like that in the ancient Near East. You're just saying that the general tenor of it was not that way?
Yeah. Well, you have morality reflected in thou shalt not steal, for example, but in the sexual morality it's lacking. When you compare the, you know, the pagan nations with the biblical laws. Yeah. We find concern for underprivileged people, slaves, for example, poor, widows, orphans, aliens, and so on. So there's a much higher standard, I think, in the biblical laws. There's a concern for inner attitudes in the biblical law. Concern for a person's attitude towards his enemies. And the biblical laws tend to be shorter, with more reliance on the overriding principles. The laws are trying to set down principles to be followed and not necessarily cover every instance of every situation that might arise. They are direction pointers. So we see quite a big difference between biblical law and these other law codes. And when we compare them, we see that based on the subject matter, the form, the linguistic usage of biblical laws, our closest parallels are in the first half of the second millennium, between 2000 and 1500 BC, so that the biblical law, as far as when it was written down, would have to be earlier rather than later. Our best parallels when we compare the biblical law with the other ancient Near Eastern law codes comes from the first half of the second millennium, between 2000 and 1500 BC. And so, based on that, then we would have to say that the biblical laws were probably written down around the time of Moses, rather than, as some have tried to make a case for writing, you know, the Pentateuch much later. And here we have some comparative material which points to an early time for the composition of the Pentateuch.
The only problem is that those parallels we have today belongs to the time, 2,000 years ago, therefore it coincides better. But the liberals are claiming is that we don't have a biblical autographs where probably this will have happened, so it's not the word at the state at the time. Based on the information of that. How you can debate
Well, I think just the fact that the form would put us back into an earlier time, and that has been carried down through the centuries, And you see some evidence of some later editing or some later maybe word spelling or some indications that there was some work done on the Old Testament in the pre-exilic period, but the basic format of those laws puts us way back. It's not post-exilic or, you know, whenever they would want to date the composition of the Old Testament. Yeah.
Is that what you're saying with these parallels? That if we would look at later ancient Near Eastern laws, they are different, and the biblical ones, by their form, are more like the old, not the new.
Yes, right, okay. Exactly. Yes, right.
So that, would answer a liberal charge.
Well, you would think so.
What if it is the evolution of the monotheism?
Yeah. Well, we find a similar thing with regard to these covenants, and that's what I want to get into next, are the treaties. This was something fairly common in the ancient world. It was a way of regulating behavior so that some measure of trust and predictability could be introduced into the social and political life of antiquity. The ancients referred to these treaties as oaths and stipulations. Usually they were agreements between a king and his vassal. And we refer to these as suzerainty treaties. And we find that through time the format of this treaty changed. And again, we find that our biblical covenant, if you will, between God and Israel is more like the earlier ones than the later ones. In fact, it's identical in format to the early second millennium treaties. These come mainly from the Hittite archives at Bogoskoy, dating from 1400 to 1200 BC. And again, we have some of those here in the Ancient Near East, Volume 2, pages 42 to 45. And these all follow a very distinct pattern in the second millennium. First, we have the preamble, or the title of this covenant. This would identify the author of the covenant. And then we have the historical prologue. And in this, the previous relationships between the parties are described. Then thirdly, we have the stipulations. These are the obligations laid upon the vassal by the sovereign. And then fourthly, we have requirement to deposit a copy of this agreement, this covenant, in the temple of the vassal's god. And then, secondly, provision for an annual or periodic reading, a public reading of the terms of the covenant. It's to be read to witnesses. And this is a listing of the deities of both the sovereign and the vassal. And then six, we have the curses. If the vassal disobeys, breaks any of the terms, of course, there will be curses invoked upon him by these deities. But on the other hand, if he obeys, then there will be blessings. So that is the second millennium format. When we get to the first millennium, it's somewhat different. First, we have the preamble or the title. But then 2, 3, and 4 are stipulations and curses succeeded or preceded by the divine witnesses. And the order varies. In other words, we're missing the historical prologue, and we're missing the blessings. They are not there. So we have stipulations and curses with the divine witnesses. But the order varies. In the second millennium, the witnesses come between the stipulations and the blessings and curses, but that is not the case in the first millennium. They either come before or after, never in between. And in the first millennium, we do not have any examples of a historical prologue. Yes, of what we have. The first millennium are mainly the Assyrian treaties. And you have some of these in ancient Near East 1, 45 to 69. And the second millennium, as I said, are the Hittite treaties from Bogaskoy. The second millennium format is very consistent in this order. They all follow the same order, but in the first millennium, the order varies with these witnesses going either before the stipulations and curses or afterwards. We see the format of the Old Testament covenant is definitely second millennium. We have all of these aspects in our Old Testament covenants. Yeah.
These two formats, how many of these covenant treaties based this part? Are there many of them that came out of this or is there any?
I don't have the exact number, but it's quite a significant number. It's not just two or three. It's dozens, I would say, on that order. So if we were to look at the Ten Commandments, for example, we would see aspects of this format. We look at Exodus 20. It begins by saying, "And God spoke all these words." Many times these covenants are referred to as the words of a suzerain. And we see that's exactly how God begins these Ten Commandments, and God spoke all these words. Verse 2, "I am the Lord your God," and this corresponds to the preamble. And then it goes on, "Who brought you up, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery?" And this would correspond to this historical prologue, the reminder of the past relationship. And then we begin with the stipulations. You shall have no other gods before me, and so on. And although we don't have it here in Exodus 20, we have several instances or several references to the filing of the law in the Ark of the Covenant. Of course, the witnesses are missing. God himself is the witness. You don't need a list of witnesses, so that part is not present in our Old Testament covenants. But we have provision for the deposit of the written covenant, and of course provision for periodic reading of the covenant. And then the blessings and cursings we have several places in the Old Testament. So we see the same concept, the same format in use by God when he gave the covenant to the nation of Israel. I think it was something that was familiar to the people, and he was simply using a familiar format. Question?
How much time do you take to make a covenant? Because when you refer to Exodus 20, then if you talk about the curses and blessings, the curse in the Deuteronomy, I mean, there's a lot of time period that has gone by. If you talk about the treaty that is made between the Lord and the vessel,
usually it's all done all at one time. Yeah. Yeah, there's different aspects of it here and there. Yeah.
Make some distinction between the text of the covenant and the ceremony of the covenant. You actually have a
yeah.
An animal and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That would be kind of the making of the covenant.
Right. And they're two different things that happen at different times. Yeah. But it's reflecting this whole concept, I think, that we see was in common use in the second millennium.
About the rituals and cults.
About the what?
Laws in reference to the relating to rituals and cults.
Yes.
Sacrificial
laws. Right.
Is there any similarity between the rituals and
yes. Yeah, the animal sacrifices, and there's various points of similarity.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain that? Is that your next question? Well, I guess there's different viewpoints on that, and that's probably more in the area of theology. My idea on it is we see a lot of similar points between many things in the Old Testament and the ancient Near Eastern world. You know, we've talked about the creation stories, the flood stories, and all of that. So how do we account for all this? My idea is that man carried these concepts as they spread around to different parts of the world. And I believe it all derived from God, from revelation, but it was carried off and then it was corrupted. And so you see these similar aspects even in religion, but it's been corrupted and it's used in a totally different way. Of course, you know, the modern scholar would say, no, the biblical people, the Israelites, they are copying from these pagan religions. Well, I don't know. We have sacrifice going back to Noah, you know. I mean, he sacrificed. And so it's been, according to the Bible, it's been part of mankind's worship of God from the beginning. And so it could easily be carried, you know, off and used in other ways down through the centuries. Yeah.
And we found the place these texts were circumcised.
The Egyptians circumcised. Now, exactly how that functioned, I'm not sure if that was religion or I'm not sure. I don't know. But
there's no problem with the existence of sacrifice. Substitution of rites, rituals of that,
Yeah. Well, take that up with your theology professors. Yeah.
Kitchen mentions 30 some trees in
Okay. Yeah, okay. Quite a good collection, I think, to base these conclusions on. How many laws are there? 300 and something? I forget the number in the Old Testament. Oh, that many. Okay, wow, yeah. See, the longest we had here was what? The Code of Hammurabi, where we have 282. Yeah. I haven't done a thorough study to see, you know, what the comparison is, but individual laws seem to be shorter in the Old Testament, but there's more of them, I guess, the larger number of them. Well, okay, let's take a break now because our next hour is going to be quite long as we get into the whole matter of the conquest. So why don't we take 5 or 10 minutes and then we'll get right into the conquest issue. All right, great, thank you. The matter of the conquest has been probably the hottest topic in biblical archaeology and biblical history for quite a number of years, and it's still so today and probably occupies the attention of more people than any other aspect of biblical history. I'd like to sort of trace one theory in detail and not to bother so much with some of the others, but just to, as we get underway, to just tell you what some of the major ideas have been. Of course, in the Bible, we are told that the Israelites came into the land from outside. They had wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and they came in as a unified group of 12 tribes under the leadership of Joshua, and they went throughout the land, and they defeated Canaanite armies and destroyed Canaanite cities. And this all took place in a relatively short period of time. We shouldn't think that it happened in a month or a year, but a number of years. And in fact, from the age of Caleb, the information given about the age of Caleb, you can work out that it took maybe 7 years or so for the whole conquest phase. And then it seems that the Israelites went to their various tribal allotments and continued to kind of struggle and continue with a sort of a mop-up operation, I guess you could call it. So this whole process took some time. It wasn't a lightning strike as such. In retrospect, maybe you could consider it that in 7 years, but it took some time for them to defeat these Canaanite city-states, according to the account we have in Joshua and also in Judges chapter 1. While I'm speaking about the biblical presentation, let me also touch on one other point, and that is many scholars will say that we have two different accounts of the conquest. We have one in the book of Joshua, which paints a very rosy picture of defeat of all these Canaanite kings by the Israelites. But then we have a second account, the more realistic account, given in Judges chapter 1, which indicates that it wasn't all that easy, and in fact, there were many areas that the Israelites could not conquer. And scholars will say this is probably the more realistic account of the two accounts. Well, I take issue with that particular viewpoint. I think G. Ernest Wright, perhaps, was the first one to put forward this idea. He wrote an article in BA way back quite some time ago, but you see reference to this often by scholars, these two different presentations of the conquest by, of course, different authors and different traditions and so on. If you study these two accounts, you'll see that in the book of Joshua, the emphasis is on the victories, whereas in the book of Judges, the emphasis is on the defeats. So it's a matter of emphasis. The book of Judges, of course, is emphasizing the sinfulness of the Israelites and their failures and how God had to judge them because of their sinful ways. Now, if you look carefully in the book of Joshua, you'll see that those areas that the Israelites could not conquer are listed there. There's no detailed information given. It just says the Israelites could not take this place or that place. And if you take and draw up a list of the areas the Israelites could not conquer in the book of Joshua, and you compare it with the listing in Judges chapter 1 of the areas the Israelites could not conquer, it's the exact same list. So it's a matter of emphasis. It's not a different story at all, but a different emphasis. In Joshua, a lot of space is given to the great victories at Jericho and so on. And very little space is given for the defeats or the areas where they could not gain victory. They're just simply listed. So that's my opinion on that whole matter. So at any rate, that would be the biblical model of the conquest of the land, is that the Israelites came in as a unified people according to biblical chronology sometime around 1400, maybe 1410, but sometime in that time frame, and conquered the land by force of arms and then settled there in the land of Canaan. Well, of course, scholars aren't about to accept that rendering of events, and they have their own ideas on things. And so they have developed a number of different theories over the years as to how Israel came into the land. Now, the problem here is that we know there was a nation of Israel. Nobody can question that. We have plenty of extra-biblical evidence from the Assyrian archives referring to kings of Israel and Judah and various events that are also detailed for us in the Old Testament. So although at one time scholars would question some of these things, now they're not questioned. It has to be accepted that there was a nation of Israel that lived in Palestine. So the problem is, how do we explain where these people came from? How did this nation come into existence? The Bible tells us how, but for those who don't like to accept the biblical account of things, they have to come up with alternatives. And so there are a number of alternative suggestions as to how Israelite came into being. So there is, of course, a conquest theory. And there's two parts to that. There would be the early date, which is really what I call the biblical date, which of course is the 1400, roughly 1400 date. And then there's the idea of a late date for the Exodus and conquest. This was developed primarily by W.F. Albright, and according to this theory, the conquest would have taken place about 1230 B.C. Albright's idea was that the Bible gives us roughly what happened, but it's not precise, and you can't take it literally, but he believed there was some evidence for a conquest by the Israelites toward the end of the 13th century B.C. Then we have another idea of that it didn't happen all at one time, but it happened over a period of centuries, and we would call this the infiltration theory, or the infiltration model. And this was a favorite of the Germans, And in fact, many Israelis like this particular idea, and they follow this theory yet today. In the 1950s, George Mendenhall made a novel suggestion based on his study of the Amarna letters. He came up with the idea that there was not a conquest at all from the outside, Israelites coming in from outside, but rather it was an internal revolt within Canaan, and he called it it's been called the peasant revolt theory. And according to this theory, the Israelites were originally peasants in the land of Canaan. Canaanites, I guess you'd have to describe them. And they rose up against their overlords, the Canaanite kings of the late Bronze Age, and were able to overpower them. And somehow somebody had this idea of a monotheistic religion, and they came together and formed a group following this religious idea, and eventually became a nation.
So, same.
No, that has to do with the 12 tribes, and that idea is pretty well dead today. The idea of 12 tribes worshiping at one center and organized along the idea of the Greek city-states or something, that has pretty well been shown not to be applicable to Israel. Now, this is different. This derives from the Amarna letters, where we read that there was a certain amount of unrest, and based on that, in the 14th century is when the Amarna letters were written. Based on that unrest, Mendenhall felt that this erupted later in the 13th century and resulted in the formation of the Israelite nation. Well, today we have yet another idea, and it's similar to this peasant revolt, but yet it has some differences, and that's simply the emergence theory. Or model. A peasant revolt would be that in the late 13th century, about the 1230 date, is when this revolt took place. The infiltration would be over centuries throughout the course of the late Bronze Age. But the emergence theory relates to the 12th century, B.C., and according to this theory, that's when the Israelites came into being. And they simply emerged from the indigenous population. But there was no revolt. They simply coalesced somehow and formed a nation. We'll talk a little bit more about this in a bit. Now, most evangelicals, as far as I can determine, have followed this theory of a conquest at around 1230. At least, if you look in all the books on biblical archaeology, that's the theory that you will read about. And at least in archaeological circles, you don't find very few proposing this earlier date, this what I would call the biblical model of a conquest in 1400 B.C. That's an extremely minority position. I mean, there's a handful of us, maybe some evangelical Old Testament scholars or theologians would follow it, but in the areas of archaeological research and evangelicals involved in archaeological research, the majority follow this late date theory. The other theories, the infiltration and peasant revolt, seem to have given way in recent years to this emergence theory. Although, like I say, I think there's some Israelis that still hold to the infiltration. I think most people have abandoned this peasant revolt in favor of the emergence theory. For a time, quite a few non-evangelicals followed this idea of a conquest in the late 13th century. But the evidence for that has dissipated, and so those folks have, as far as I can tell, gone over to this emergence theory. Now, since this late-date conquest idea is the one that evangelicals have followed, I would like to look at that in some detail to see how it came about and also look at the evidence for its demise. And it's because of this dating here of the arrival of Israel or the appearance of Israel around 1230 that time frame has been attached to these other theories as well. The peasant revolt and the emergence theory has pushed it off a little bit to the 12th century, but we're talking basically sometime around 1200 BC. Yeah.
Did you say that the evangelical thing? I remember from some weeks back, you said that it is a crucial matter to say that the Exodus occurred in 1440 or 1450 because there is no archaeological evidence to say that there was any conquest in the 1200s.
Yes.
And then that would make the historical record of Joshua a big question mark. And yet it's still called that evangelical.
This is the problem we have today. As I go around to various seminaries talking about this whole problem, evangelicals don't even realize it's a problem. They're in the dark as to, you know, what's happening in scholarship. So I'm not really sure where it's all going to fall out. Now, in your reading assignment, I gave you this article by Walke. This is sort of the latest thing that's come out on the whole matter. It was in the Westminster Theological Journal in 1990, the date of the conquest. And he goes through the evidence, you know, for an early date, a late date, and he comes up with the conclusion at the very end, the evidence, however, does not support conclusively either the early date or the late date models of the conquest. He doesn't know what's going on. He's not an archaeologist. He's not familiar with the data. There is no data for a late-date conquest. And never mind the data, the Bible doesn't allow it. I mean, if you look at all the texts and scriptures and just look at all the internal evidence, it's not a matter of either or choice, it's, from my point of view. Maybe I'm too narrow. You're quite right, you know, that evangelicals who still follow this, there's no evidence for it now. It's pretty well gone, and I don't know where it's going to come out, you know. There was another interesting statement by a fellow from Dallas, Ivor Bach or something Bach. He reviewed this article, and he says, it looks like this emergence theory is the correct view. I mean, he just ignores the Bible. And he's supposed to be an evangelical. So I don't know where we're headed with this whole matter. But it's important, I think, because in this emergence theory, the Israelites come from indigenous people. They come from the Canaanites. There's no a sojourn in the wilderness. There's no crossing of the Jordan River. There's no exodus from Egypt and crossing of the Yam Suf. I mean, you've done away with some of the greatest events in the Old Testament when you follow this kind of a theory. So I think these issues are important. I think we need to examine them closely.